Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back. Hey, we have a special guest today for you. We have the honor of hosting Chief Warrant Officer 2, Nick Lavery, an active duty U.S. Army Special Forces Green Beret. And Nick made history as the first above-the-knee amputee to return to combat, demonstrating unparalleled determination and courage. And beyond his military accolades, including a Silver Star and 3 Purple Hearts, Nick is the founder and CEO of Precision Components and Team Machine. Those two organizations are highly dedicated to training, inspiring others in leadership, resilience, in and out of uniform. So, hey, with that quick intro being there, Nick, we wanted to say thank you for being here today.
Nah, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on. I've been looking forward to this discussion for a while, man. So let's get into it.
Yeah, and I one thing I always like to throw out there is like how we got connected, because a lot of people, they'll look at you, they'll look at other people out there, and they go, man, one day I want to be able to get out there and meet that person, or I could never do what he's being able to do. And what's crazy is it's very similar to how we got in touch with John Troxell. It was like it was a simple message, simple email right off of your website, and you replied back, and I think the conversation just kind of started from there. So granted, you're a very busy individual, but we're all real people, and you know, it was awesome. And I'm glad we've learned a lot from you since.
I'm glad you did. You know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, you know, so you never know. And to your point, which I love, is we are real people. And I think, not to go off on a tangent here, but I was recently back up home. I was in Boston, and I reconnected with a dude that I knew like way back in the day. And, you know, he hit me up out of the blue, and I just happened to be in the same area. He was going to be the same time. He's like, hey, man, I know you got a million things, but, you know, you think you could squeeze in. I'd love to just see you and shake your hand and see how you're doing. I'm like, yeah, absolutely, man. So we met for a quick coffee, like midday. It was like 15 minutes. Sat down. How you doing? How's the family? I haven't seen this dude in almost 20 years, maybe longer than 20 years. And, you know, 10, 12 minutes into it, we're like coming up on time. And he looks at me and he goes, dude, I don't know how to say this, but you're like the same guy. And that to me is like one of the greatest compliments that you can get. You know, you get into the world like social media and business, and it becomes this whole crazy kind of like animal. And in a lot of ways, I'm certainly different today than I was 20 plus years ago. But to his point, I think what he was making was, I'm a down to earth human, as you just said, Chad, like we're people. And to keep a clear visibility of that and not let, you know, your ego get too big, or your head get too big because of success or followers or like whatever things we're paying attention to, was, I think, is incredibly important. And that, you know, that dude just gave me that gift not that long ago. Pretty cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's awesome. I guess that'll segue, since you're still the same person, if you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you grew up for the people that don't know.
Yeah. And you know, I wouldn't say it's literally accurate. I'm quite different in many ways today, you know, than I was back, you know, my college years. But originally from Boston, Mass, which probably most people listening or watching this right now has probably already figured out, despite me being gone from the city now for almost 20 years, I still talk the way I do. Although, truth be told, this is actually quite a dull version of what my accent used to be, and how much thicker it gets when I actually go back up north and I'm immersed in that environment. Very few people would understand what I'm saying unless you were from there. Originally from Boston. The highlight of my life is I'm a father and I'm a husband. My wife and I, we got 2 young boys. Our youngest just turned 4 like a week ago on St. Patrick's Day is his birthday. So tell me that kid doesn't have some wild birthdays coming up in his future. And, you know, they're the highlight of my life. You know, it's like if all I really ever did in life was be a good husband and be a good father, that would be more than enough to me to hang my hat on and look back on my life with a lot of gratitude and feeling like I won. On the professional side, you mentioned already, Chad, I'm an active duty Green Beret. I'm in 5th Group here at Fort Campbell. Been doing this now almost 19 years. Came right in as an 18 X-ray, which is also known as a Special Forces recruit. So guys off the street, you just go straight into the pipeline. That's what I did. And my second professional life, and I do mean it that literally, so one is that of an active duty soldier, and then 2 is that of an entrepreneur or business owner operator. Although at this point, they're both almost full-time jobs. So I kind of live 2 full-time professional lives. And as you and I were talking about before you hit the record button, you know, one of the greatest challenges I have, maybe the greatest, is I love everything that I get to do, and there's only 24 hours in a day. So really, it gets the hard part is deciding what not to do, the things you're not going to do that you love to do, because there's only 24 hours in a day, and how you're going to spend it.
Yeah, no, and I think that's absolutely spot on. I want to tap on that too. Like once we get towards the end, and one of the things I want to bring up is threw it out in your bio that you were injured. You were the first above the knee amputee that ended up deploying back on an ODA. And one of the questions I wanted to ask is, prior to your injury, we always talk about having a baseline. You know, and the baseline isn't always sexy, right? Whether it's your mind, physical, mental, emotional, like toughness and sets and reps, being able to get that in. So prior to your injury, how did you train and going through all the deployments and stuff that you do, or you did actually, I'm sorry, all the deployments and stuff you did, after that injury, did you look back and think, hey, there's probably some areas I could have done better in that now I want to be able to pass off to other people? Because your recovery is like one of a phenomenal story in itself.
Yeah. I'll tell you, when I got to the teams in 2009, right around that time was when the Thor program really started to come around, and it was still very new and we didn't have any space. And so it was still conceptual and they were starting to operationalize this a bit, but changing the way we trained physically on the teams, that was the initiation of what has become like just the way to do business now, you know, almost 20 years later. And I fully immersed myself in that. My mission in training was to be the greatest team guy that I could be. It wasn't about looking a certain way. I didn't care about aesthetics or like my physique. It was all based on performance, and they were there to train us as performance athletes. And I played football in college, so I was familiar with training in that manner. And now when I got to the teams, it was very, very similar. So I was right at home with that training philosophy, even though for some of the older guys, this was like a whole new way to go about business, like bands and chains and like moving heavy weight, dynamic movements. Like a lot of my early teammates, they came from the regular army and like PT, they get up and they go run 5 miles, like 6 days a week. That was just like what you did. A bunch of push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups. So I'm not against those exercises, but it was a whole different way to go about physically. So I look back on that as it pertains to my injury and give a lot of the credit to how I was able to recover based off of my baseline prior to injury. You could also make the argument, as doctors have told me, you know, the statement, strong people are harder to kill, is not just a cool buzz phrase. It's actually true. Like according to science, you know, strong people are harder to kill. We're talking strong physically and strong mentally, which are clearly linked to each other. As one builds, the other one tends to build. So it's fair to say that you and I aren't having this conversation right now, because what probably should have happened in 2013, that be me dying, probably would have happened or easily could have happened had I not had that baseline to begin with moving in. And then in terms of things I think I could have done differently, wish I did differently, I can't say that it relates specifically to my injury or my recovery, more so just kind of old guy things where, you know, back as a 24-year-old, you can blow off like the stretching and the range of motion and like the recovery stuff, even parts of your nutrition. You know, my stuff was pretty dialed in, but at that age, you don't need the sleep, the recovery, the types of calories, the types of, you know, injury prevention techniques that I rely heavily on today as a 42-year-old man. Now that I didn't need to take that much pay that much attention to it back then. So I had a lot more margin of what I could blow off, which is very common. Most young people listening to this are going to be like, yeah, whatever, dude, like I'll deal with being old when I get old. I got it. Like chances are you're not paying attention. But what I can say with a degree of certainty is if you make those investments now, whether you need them, quote unquote, or not, I think the more important part is operationalizing those elements of training into your regiment so that it just becomes more automated in the way that you do it. So yeah, it will likely mitigate some challenges down the road, but when those challenges show up regardless, it's less of a learning curve on how to implement some of this stuff, because, you know, the body and the mind, certainly when you're in the business that we're in, you know, it takes a toll. So I think the more long-term thinking you can be and the more investments you can make into your body, into your mind, and into your social lives prior to it being like a whole, like break glass in case of emergency like situation, I think the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because not too long ago, I think you said something, right? Like, hey, all the health modalities that are out there are great, but it's never going to excuse the hard work that you got to go out there and put on.
Dude, you got to. In terms of human performance, there is no getting around hard physical training, effective recovery, and fueling your body appropriately. And in today's world where people are looking for the, you know, the hack to circumvent the grind, you are not going to get around that. So the sooner you can accept those as requirements, the better. And it's hard and it takes time and energy and effort, but that's the foundation. And I'm not against the sauna, the cold tubs, the cupping, or like, you know, whatever biohack modalities you want to do to prevent an injury or recover from an injury or increase your longevity or health. I think these are all great things, but you know, that's the salt and pepper on the meal. Like the steak, the potatoes, and the vegetables are not going away. If you remove those, you got a plate of dust that isn't going to really give you a whole lot. You got to have the meat. You got to have the core tenets of the meal, and then you can season it with whatever you want. But you're not going to get around those requirements.
So I was thinking, like, what you bring up a good point. The one thing, like, as far as your mental preparation, when you're going through injury recovery, what were you telling yourself daily when the pain was freaking, feel like it was unbearable?
Dude, I don't know where I heard it or if I just came up with it on my own, but it's still an expression I use today. I actually have it on a whiteboard in my closet right now, which is where I get ready for the day. And it is, this is the cost of admission. That's it. That is what I would tell myself back then when I was literally face down on the ground and figuratively face down on the ground, trying to learn how to walk again as a one-legged guy with a prosthetic. This is the cost of admission. It's like, you could say you want something and maybe you do really want it, but the hard truth is the answer to the how bad do you want it question lies in your actions, period. And you can look back in time, a day, a week, a month, a year. The answer to the question is in those choices that you made. That's it. You know, so I decided, it was a conscious decision, that I was going to go back to the teams after getting wounded. That's it. This is what you're going to do. Okay. This is going to be really hot. Yeah, I'm sure it is, but we'll figure it out. Fine. Easy things to say. But then when you're in the moment, that's when it's time to put your money where your mouth is. This is the cost. There are going to be countless costs to this goal that you have in mind. It's going to cost you a lot. You are about to pay one of those costs right now. Or, because it's a choice, or don't pay those costs and go do something else. Like, I think it really is that simple. I think oftentimes we can overcomplicate or over-engineer this whole thing. It's like, this is incredibly simple. It's not to say that it's easy, right? It's not easy, but it is simple. And I just saw it that simply is in this moment of struggle, of pain, of failure, of fear, of all these emotions that I'm dealing with as I'm on this roller coaster ride, trying to get back to living the life that I love. Every one of those moments was an opportunity for me to pay those costs. And I'm going to continue to pay in and pay and pay and pay and pay, just like making any investment in anything. Whether it's in a financial investment, a social investment into a relationship, like you're going to pay into that with the belief that it's going to garner a greater return at some point. Same exact concept. That's what I applied. This is the cost of admission. You either do it or you don't. That's it.
You gave me, you made me think about, I was listening to a short podcast, the prior president, Barack Obama, you know, not to talk politics or anything like that. He said one thing he missed is just going to the grocery store. Nobody knows his name. And I think there was a famous artist or whatever. And he said, he was talking to him about it. He said, this is the cost of living your dreams out loud.
That's good.
Freaking, at the end of the day, you know, people will say, hey, Nick gets to live this way. No, this is the cost of a mission. Like, I decided to buy the ticket to the game and I get to go to the game and I get to enjoy the game, not sit here and complain about I can't go in. I bought it. I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to enjoy it to the fullest of my ability. So that's really good.
Yeah, the good with the bad. I wrote that down. You know, it comes with costs. Like, even the greatest of wins is going to come with costs along the journey to get there, and even while you're there. Like, when you're standing on top of the mountain, looking at this view that you spent a year or 10 years working your ass off to get to, you paid countless costs on the way. But even when you're there, you're paying costs because of that. So, like, that's the game of life, man. I think at the end of the day, like, one of the beautiful things about it as humans is we all have the same superpower, and that is free will. But we decide what we want to do. Like, a tree, not a whole lot of options there, right? A dog, like, limited options if you're a dog, or an apple, or an ant, or a virus. Like, we're human beings. The superpower we exist is the ability to choose. And, you know, it's not to say that it's going to be easy, like I said, but we do have it, and it's just a series of options we get presented with every single day. What do you want to do with them?
That's good.
I'm going to steal a term that always gets thrown around, and I was talking to a handful of police officers, which I know you do fairly often. And we like to always say, especially in this community, hey, we're a master of the basics. You're a master of the basics. Like, okay. I think also with that comes checking your ego. And again, it goes back to the cost of admission. It's all one piece here of the baseline. The baseline you built prior to getting injured is what helped you on the recovery journey. Is that you felt, right? Like I do. I go into work every day, and I feel like I'm walking among giants. And I got to check my ego and realize, like, the things like we talked about before we got on here, right? About to go get my teeth kicked in for the next 30 hours or something. It's the cost. It's the cost to be able to stand among people. And as I was talking to these police officers, I'm like, you have to find those people that you want to attract, right? And something, Security Halt podcast, Denny, he told me something a couple weeks ago that blew, I just never thought about it. And he said the team room's always bigger on the outside. And I was like,
interesting.
That's a good point. And that can be applied to anybody, right? Like your support system, your ability to find that tribe and build it and check your ego. Those people are out there. You just got to be able to find them. Which brings me into my next question here of after your injury, what was like your personal support like compared to, you know, your work support system? Was that like a hard balance to find? Because I know, like you've described already in other stories, like you went all in on it, right? There was nothing else happening except I'm getting back.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's something I don't really talk about very often. I'll share it here. So my now wife, we had known each other for years. Active duty and special operations. We're both out of Fort Bragg. Knew each other for a really long time. And it was when I was deployed in 2012, and she was also deployed in 2012. We're both in Afghanistan, two different spots. Me and my team were out doing VSO, and she's working out of Bagram. But that was kind of like the beginning of what we thought was something more than like a friendship. It was all like remotely. We weren't physically together, but it was like, oh man, like you're kind of like my support system while I'm here. We're on the same time zone. You're fully aware of the things that we're doing, so I can talk to you openly. I think this might be something real. And then boom, I get banged up. I should die. I'm at like the absolute lowest point in my life. She gets home, and now she's kind of along for the ride with me, although we really didn't know what this was. So it's kind of this perfect storm of me professionally, physically, socially, like a lot of things are moving around all at the same time, and I'm trying to navigate through it despite being on enormous doses of ketamine, going through surgery every other day. So there's a lot going on. But once things kind of settled a little bit, I was still at the hospital. She very quickly became that teammate for me. And, you know, when she could, she'd come up to Walter Reed. When I could, I'd get down to North Carolina. It was great. I was there for a year. And then I got out and I moved in with her right after I left the hospital. And I hadn't been home more than like a week. And the entire time I'm at Walter Reed, at least once I was off of enough drugs to start putting together like a game plan and then start implementing that game plan, my training, my skills, like how am I going to get back to a team? So I got this whole thing mapped out. I get home, I'm with her, I'm there like a week or so, and I sit her down and I'm like, hey, I think we need to have a conversation, and I just want you to know that this is what my life is gonna look like, and I don't know how long it's gonna look this way. And it literally was a 24-hour schedule. I actually have it printed. It's in my book. You can see what a day looked like for me. And it was, I'm going to live this as close to perfect as humanly possible. It had, like, to the minute and to, like, the gram of protein to the calorie, like, every single minute was accounted for. I'm going to live this way as closely to perfect as I can. And I don't know how long it's going to take for me to make this goal real, but I have to go completely all in on this. And I understand if you don't want to be along with me for this ride, because what that means for us is there will be no dinners. There will be no vacations. You know, if someone dies, like, I'm not going to the funeral, like that level of all in, which is an easy expression to throw around, but I meant that literally. And I think she knew that. I went into that conversation, guys, with every expectation being that she was going to hear me out and then be like, you know what? I didn't sign up for this. This sounds crazy. And I'm not about it. And that would have been it. That would have been it. And I could see then the life that we live now. I knew that what we had was real. I could see the kids. I could see the dogs. I could see the house. Like, I'm living now, today, the vision I had 12 years ago during this discussion. And it's a moment that I am equally proud of being able to do and equally shameful of. I feel guilt about it. It's about a 50-50 split of, man, I probably wouldn't be where I am today had I not been that obsessed with making this a reality. But also, I look at the family we have now and the kids that we have now. And had she done maybe the more practical option, this wouldn't exist. And what a tragedy that would be. Because these are two awesome little dudes. I'm biased, they're my kids. But man, like, I look at these kids and I'm like, you guys shouldn't be here for like a whole variety of reasons. You guys really should not exist. So I look back on that one conversation, feeling pretty bad about myself, but also proud of myself. It's a really weird dynamic. And, you know, her response was basically, yeah, cool, man. Like, let's do this. Like, let's get to work. And so she not only became my support system, but she became a teammate for me. She was an asset for me to rely on and to push me and to hold me accountable. And, you know, I can say with confidence that I don't make it back. I don't live the life I live now had it not been for her.
You know, you make me think this, you said practical. You were looking for like a practical answer. When you talk to her about in practicality.
Yeah. So I was expecting a practical response as I was talking about insanity. That's a great point, man.
You know, and maybe this is me reaching and I'm making an assumption. My mom said, when you make an assumption, you make it out of yourself. So, you were with somebody who saw you go through and didn't walk away from you. You were at Walter Reed. Like, you were with the person that was impractical already. She was already in uniform, impractical. Mm-hmm. Regardless if it had worked out or not, she was already impractical. And she said, yeah, I like this dude. And I'm gonna stay around him. And, hey, you can move in with me. You know, but there was other thing you said, guilt. What? Tell me that guilt feeling. Like, why do you feel guilty about achieving a dream?
Yeah, it's not, I guess it's not so much about achieving the dream. It's about the choice in that moment that I made to sacrifice and give up what today is the best part of my life. I was confident that this was where it was going. It was like, that this is real. But I have to be willing to walk away from that if that's what it takes. And okay. I was willing to do that. And if she had done the normal thing, which, great point, Mac, because she's far from normal in a lot of different ways, I would have been like, I totally get it. I respect that. I'll love you forever, and I'm out. And I'll figure out where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do. But like, that's the level of commitment I have to this. And it made me feel bad then. And even as I reflect on it now, I'm like, man, you know, I was willing to give this up. I was willing to give this up because I was that obsessed with it.
Oh, man. Here's another question. So now we're going to talk about the boys. Because we're all dealing with this, right? All of us had a different upbringing that gave us the grit that said, yes, I'm going to keep on going forward, right? Yours, your situation was much different than most of ours. So that's understandable. How are you going to ensure that those boys develop the grit? Because quite frankly, they don't have to have some of the struggles that you grew up with in the 80s and in the 90s.
I think this is the challenge, you know, especially for parents, maybe slightly more specifically, I'll go ahead and say it for fathers that are raising boys. My job is to create caring, decent, kind, compassionate, savage, MFing animals that are driven by integrity, emotional well-being, and ambition. And like, that's my mission in life. Highly capable human beings that with a high degree of emotional control. And if you were trying to create like the most capable person on the planet, the last thing that you would probably do would be isolate them from struggle and challenge and failure and fear, because like those are essential reps at building mental and physical strength and toughness. So you gotta let them expose themselves to pain and failure and struggle. Us as parents, organically, we want to protect our kids. That's like rooted in our DNA, most of us anyway, unless you're like really off. We see a threat, we want to put ourselves in between the thing we love and the threat, whether that's an angry dog, it could be gravity as they're climbing a tree, you know, like we want to protect our kids. So it's this almost constant conflicting ideology or this sense of cognitive dissonance that we're dealing with in real time, like sometimes countless times a day, especially when you're the parent of two young boys that are all, both out of their minds and they're like dead set on hurting themselves or their brother every single day, all day long. So you're sitting back as a parent trying to assess these situations to determine, do you step in? Do you let this ride? As they're struggling, do you let them to continue to fumble through it, even though, you know, the clock is ticking and we got to get out of here. We're going to be late for the thing. Like, you know, he's trying to tie his shoes and you're like, oh, come on, just let me do it real quick. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, let's go. It's like you're robbing him of those moments of struggle. And that's how you build resilience, mental toughness, physical and emotional and mental capability. So it's a much easier thing said than done. And without question, there's been times when maybe I stepped in a little prematurely and probably could have let that one ride. And now this gets theoretical, so who knows? Yeah. There's certainly times when maybe I let things ride and things don't work out all that great. My wife is like, what were you thinking? You just watched him do that. I'm like, I don't know. I let that one ride. It didn't work. He's got a bump on his head or he's got a busted lip, you know? So I'm bringing all this up, guys, because I think that we as parents can be really hard on ourselves with making the wrong choice, having never known what would have happened had we gone another way. And I'll summarize this and I'll quote Jordan Peterson. I may mess it up verbatim, but you'll get the sentiment. He says, if you want to ensure the failure of your kids, stop them while they're doing dangerous things carefully. And I think that that is just so brilliantly stated because what he's suggesting is if you notice that there's a degree of strategy or tactics or thought into what they're doing, whether that's dangerous, as something that's dangerous, but you see them kind of thinking through it a little bit. Maybe that's a chance to you let that play out a little bit. I think when it enters into the realm of reckless, like dangerous behavior without any regard for risk or threat, that's perhaps when you get a little more aggressive and say, hey, dude, like, what are you thinking right now? Okay, you're 20 feet off the ground in a tree and there's no other branches to choose from. Like, where are you going? You know, maybe like prompt a little thought. So that's just a quick, you know, quote that I come back to in these moments. Dangerous things carefully. You want them doing dangerous things at times. You want them doing scary things at times. You want them feeling the consequences of getting it wrong and struggle. And at the same time, we have an obligation to protect them. And I think we just, you know, we go round and around and we navigate that the best we can. But what my parents did to me as a young person was they did not put me in this bubble of protection, right? They were sending me back out into the game day after day after day, giving me guidance, giving me mentorship, then sending me right back out to get my ass kicked by the world, sometimes most of the time literally. And I give a lot of my successes and credit, my successes today, crediting them on their ability to do that. And that's really my mission with my kids.
That's good.
Yeah, you make a good point. Everything, a lot of what you just described too, because can be used by individuals that are, right, leaders, if you will, right? Leaders, because depending on what people's definition of leaders are, but how do you let your people go? How do you let them learn the lessons? When do you step in? When do you, so like I'm interested now, right? Cause I know we're short on time, is for like Precision Components, Team Machine, what, like, specifically are you guys going out there talking about, like, your mission and taking, like, those lessons learned that you just talked about and reinvigorating them into organizations?
Leadership is it's a broad topic. It's one that we focus on. It's easy to, like, throw that term out there and then, you know, what does that even really mean? But I would argue that winning organizations have strong leadership. When we're operating on the ODA and we're either looking at a group to go work alongside of bilaterally, or we are getting one handed to us, that is the first thing that we assess. What is their current leadership construct? What is the current leadership strength? Because if it does not exist, that is something that we have to implement almost immediately to make any of this work. And then from there, we can work on skills and culture and, like, teamwork and, like, all these other things. But you have to have somebody, or ideally a lot of somebodies, that are influencing, inspiring, enabling, and empowering the group, irrelevant to title. Doesn't matter what your rank is or your pay grade. Like, forget all that. There's leadership and there's leadership positions. And those are two wildly different things. And what we would love is that every leadership position is filled by a leader. The three of us know that that's not always the case. So taking, I think, those hard lessons learned, for me personally anyway, through my work in the military and having seen great leadership and great leaders, and also the valuable lessons I've learned from horrible leaders that I've been around, which are also providing me value, things I don't want to do, things I don't want to replicate, and here's why, and pumping that into the minds and the brains and the hearts of the clients that we get to work with. And dude, it's wild to see incredibly high performing organizations that we get to work with. I'm talking about pro sports teams, like Fortune 500 companies. These are groups of people that are winning according to, like, every possible metric you could come up with. And then when we come in there with some of this material and these concepts and actual tools that the three of us and many of our colleagues have learned through on the battlefield and through fire, literally, you would think that we just invented fire right in front of them, like, in the room. Like, minds are, like, exploding. And some of these concepts, I think, to us are very, very basic. And you mentioned, you know, masters of the basics. And that's another very easy buzz term, but it's true. And, like, that is how you win. When you look at advanced skills, and I currently am assigned to the advanced skills company in Fifth Group, like, that's where I work. Advanced skills, really, is just the employment of the basics in more complex or complicated environments. That's it. You're not changing the way you draw your holster to shoot your pistol. It's the exact same way the first time you learned it, you're doing it now in an advanced course. All we're changing is the environment in which you're doing it and your ability to employ it, the basics, in a more uncertain, dynamic environment with more constraints and variables. Now we've entered into the realm of advanced, you know, but I think a lot of those concepts kind of go unknown or unrecognized or unappreciated. And even for some very capable winning teams, when that gets brought back up to the surface, you see those light bulbs go off. And it's a lot of fun taking our language and the way that we think and operate and translating that into a way that a corporation can understand and employ, or a law enforcement organization can understand and employ, or youth program can understand and employ. That's, I think, the art form of what we get to do as instructors, is take what we know to work through our world and our lens, know enough about the people that we have a job to influence and impact, and then make it translate from us to them. And that's the beauty of it. That's the fun of it.
No, that's perfect. I smile because, again, I go back to, what is your base? Like, I've had the opportunity to talk to, you know, a few people, Mac and I, we got to go out to Kentucky, and you get the questions of, like, hey, how do I get to X, right? And you were talking about it. How do I circumvent everything to get here to be really cool, or right, or achieve the end state? And I'm like, man, you're not going to win on the mat against the opponent unless your stance is right, right? And getting all the sets and reps in. It's awesome to hear that a lot of organizations take that in and take a reevaluation, right? Instead of the, I need the right now fix problem, because we all know how that ends, right? If I go ahead and implement a policy today because somebody switched out, everything just ends up trickling down, right? And it becomes a huge, huge issue. I know you're nearing the end of your time in your career. What are your goals and plans as you look beyond that? And for some people listening, it's crazy. I had this discussion the other day at work, and people were asking me what I'm going to do after team time, right? Hey, man, are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? And I'm just like you. I'm right behind you. I'm closing in on 20. And at some point, we all transition. And if you didn't know that, surprise. It's going to happen. So as you look past, when you decide to hang it up, what are some of the things that you're going to keep getting after?
Yeah, you know, I'm in a very blessed position for many ways, but even just professionally, is I've identified what my next purpose is, professional purpose is, beyond military service. And I've had a chance to start building that foundation, that baseline, you know, that framework now for the last few years, and make seamlessly all of the mistakes and learn from them. And that's great, you know. So I know what that looks like for me already, conceptually, and then dropping the hammer in terms of time, energy, bandwidth, which is now, you know, like a 48% commitment to 100%. I'm real curious to see what that looks like, just given our like crazy growth over the last few years. We are, generally speaking, certainly military, and yeah, I'd say even in special operations, we're probably even worse at this, with kicking the transition can down the road all the way up until the game's already over. Or like, you're going to be a civilian in like a week, and now it's like, oh, what am I going to do when I grow up? Yep. It's like, yeah, you probably should have started thinking about that like 2 years ago, like at least. You know, we got like SFL TAP and all these like army like transition processes we go through, you know, whatever. The units all have their own like variant of doing kind of a thing. Some of them are good, great stuff, but I think that we generally procrastinate on that. And it's not necessarily out of fear, although that's certainly a part of it for many, many people. I think that it's because they have to continue to provide value down and in. And it's like, I'm so used to going 100 miles an hour into this thing. That's a huge part of who I am. For many, that's like all they are. Their entire identity is roped up in this one function. So there's this hesitation to not just be like judged as this like shammer shitbag, but like, I don't know how to live other than this. It's 1,000 miles an hour, all in on whatever it is my responsibilities are in this world. And they stay there all the way up until it's like, you're now a civilian, now what? It's like, oh, this is the first time I've even considered it. So what I typically recommend service members that are getting close to the end of that journey, or at least they think they're getting close, maybe, you got to stop putting in like aggressive, deliberate, intentional focus on what does the next phase of your life look like. Because here's two realities. One, as you just said, Chad, it's inevitable. It's coming, period, right? You may serve for a day, you may serve for 20, you may serve for 35. It will end. So you know it's going to end at some point. And two, this may be a tough pill to swallow, but it's true. The Army, the unit, the DOD, the ODA, it's going to go on without you the second you are no longer there. You go to the retirement ceremony, people are already thinking, they're barely paying attention in that moment. Brief moment of time. Here's your plaque. Cool. Everyone's going right back to work. The train is not going to stop. You know what? It doesn't really need you all that much. The Army was fine, or the military was fine before you. It's going to be fine without you. I don't give a shit who you are, what you do. It's not to say you don't provide value. It's not to say you're not an asset. It's just, this is a massive train that is going to keep moving. You have to prioritize yourself at a certain point, and that can be really difficult to do. But the longer you kick this can down the road, the more likely anyway that you end up in a really bad spot once you become a civilian. And how often does that lead to some pretty negative vice-like behavior? That's drugs, alcohol, women, whatever. And just, it turns into this spiral that we've all seen many, many, many times. So be proactive. When you think you need to stop paying attention to it, you probably need to move that to the left by about 6 to 12 months. That's where really I would recommend doing it. And it doesn't make you a scumbag or a poor teammate to prioritize yourself at times to set yourself up for success post-military. The Army is not going to do it for you. The military is not going to do it for you. You have to do it for yourself. And in fact, by doing so, is going to put you and the team and your family in a much better position. You got to get past that fear.
Yeah. I mean, I went through that. Absolutely went through at least communicating, hey guys, it's time for me to start transitioning, and being vocal, respectful, and just letting them know, hey, this is where I draw the line, because eventually they're going to give me orders and I have to leave, and you're not going to care. Like, no one, like, the only people who call me after I retired is those who you stay within your closest circle. Other than that, I have yet to get a phone call from a commander saying, hey, we thank you for your service. Hey, how are you doing? How's everything going? And we're 2 years post-retirement. Yeah. No one's going to do that. So you're right.
They're moving on. They got business to take care of. It's, you know, it's not personal. It's business. This is the business that we're in. It's like, you know, but to your point, Mac, you got to draw a line. You got to create a boundary, and, you know, you got to uphold that boundary. Like, this is it. You know, I can give you blank, and the rest, I got to get myself squared away, not only for myself, but for my family, period.
So I'm curious, your wife, so is she very much entrenched in the company, in Team Machine, or is she doing something outside of that?
She does her own thing. She just that retiring as well. So she's active. I mentioned Soph as well. She's been in 24, going on 25 years. So she just started officially retiring 2-3 months ago. So she got another 9 or 10 months of like her glide path before she's fully out. And she does her own thing. She's doing a lot of different things. I'm biased because she's my wife, but she's a very unique asset. And because of that comes a great problem, which is you almost have too many options being thrown her way, where it's like overwhelming. You got a lot of, you know, all the three-letter agencies are like, come over here with us, we'll do blah blah blah. The private sector is contracting, she's interested in like real estate. It's like almost so many options that it gets overwhelming and can almost like stop you in your tracks, which is a good problem to have.
Man,
it is a problem. So I'm able to like see that on the sidelines and, you know, help where and when I can, while knowing she's got to kind of navigate this on her own. She does some stuff with us in more of like an official capacity, where she'll, if we're doing like a half day or full day training workshop, she'll come in and do a block of instruction on, you know, interpersonal communication or rapport building, relationship development. She, you know, so she'll do like one-off things with us here and there. And then aside from just, hey, you know, here's a new like graphic or marketing thing that we're playing around with. Like, what are your thoughts on this? So here and there, she kind of will help us out and do some stuff. But we sat down probably 3 years ago and made it very clear that we want to keep a good separation between our professional lives and our personal lives. And we've spent most of the time we've known each other with those two worlds really right on top of each other, where we've worked together in operational capacities multiple times. And I think we both want a little bit more space in between that. And I think that's how it'll probably continue to play out.
That's funny, because my wife, she retired. She did 27. And she was like, I'm taking a gap year, because she was like, somebody said, hey, come do this, come do that. Because she did a AGR here in the state. And so she was working at the state level. Mm. And she was like, no, don't want to do that. She was like, I'm going to learn Spanish. And then she just submitted a resume because a friend told her she had an interview. She was like, if I get it, whatever, you know, but I got other things, you know, because we have twins at the house and I have three other kids that are down in Fayetteville every other weekend. And so she's like, I enjoy being bonus mom, but you can see where
bonus
she's like,
mom. Love that.
Yeah. She's like, she's bonus mom, and she's busy doing those things and being present, because she was like constantly moving when the twins were growing up, deployments and so on and so forth. So she's like, after they get out, then I'll pursue something different. But to your point of the multiple options, I found myself like, so many options, you get paralysis.
Mm, yeah.
And so it is like, okay, let's go with three COAs, and none of them are throwaways, but let's three COAs and then make a decision. I had to do that for myself because I had more than that. And then I was like, yes to everything, knowing that I was going to say no to 99% of them. But it was like the fear of even when I was preparing, and it's because you don't want to make the wrong decision, because you the assumption is you're going to do something wrong. And I think you guys have the experience, right? Not only your relationship, and because you come so far and you've been growing your business, and other people are having a conversation and transition is getting better, or other organizations are helping that process for you to get down to like, hey, let me pursue what I want to do. And it's okay if you're working for somebody to know that that first step outside of the uniform is not my last thing. And that's the same thing as an entrepreneur. You're building your business. It may morph, but it's still going to be your business. What you do today, we heard this, I think 2 days ago, what you do today may be a little bit different 5 years from now, but that's okay. But for somebody who's going to work for somebody, just know like, hey, man, I'm coming out of uniform. I'll do this for a little bit. But this is not the forever dream because things change.
Yeah, that's a good point. What's wild to almost in this discussion is my company now has, I think, 4 transitioning SF guys that are going to be doing a SkillBridge CSB program with us, which I'm like, it just kind of happened. I actually don't even know really how it happened, but it did, and then it happened fast. And then it was like, we had like 50 people being like, we want to do like an intern. I'm like, whoa, hold on a second, guys. Like, I'm all for bringing in the boys and like we can all hang out and like do stuff together, but I think we need to like operationalize this thing a little bit. So like really cool, something I never even thought of. It just kind of almost organically happened, as which oftentimes happens in business. You're like, oh man, this is a thing. I kind of stumbled upon it, and now let's polish it and operation and weaponize this thing a little bit. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I think the first one kicks off in May, I want to say it is. Just a way to kind of give back and like feed back in and give people a little bit of a glimpse of like what's out there, whether that's to enable entrepreneurship or just what's it like working in the, you know, B2B space or B2C space or service providing and, you know, product development, like the things that we do. So I'm actually really looking forward to it. I think it's gonna be a lot of fun.
It's crazy because this conversation went a little different than I thought, but it's like, it provides, no matter if you're military or civilian, like insights, right? That we're just real people. And Nick, I don't know how long ago, 3 months maybe, like when I got to talk to you last, and the first thing you said was, is this something you want to do outside, when you transition out? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. This is something I want to do. I'm building the team right now, setting the team to set conditions so we can go forward and give back through our lessons learned. And your thing was, I commend you for that, because it's a lot of work. Just in that 3 months, and what's crazy is, I mean, you talked about it giving 100% of your time, and it's crazy to see the growth. I'm only able to give like 30% of my time right now. Sure. And the amount of work that goes into just that small percentage is wild to me. So I guess that one of the last couple questions I'd ask is, what have you learned from being an entrepreneur and the amount of work that goes into it that you would tell somebody else that wants to get on the journey?
Oof. You know, it's good. I'll tell you one that came up that's recent for me. I want to say within the last like 12 or so months, but it's been something that's been on my mind. I was asked from a colleague of mine. We sit on the board together for another firm, and he's done a whole bunch of things in his life and his career. And he said, man, I love what you're doing and blah, 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 like, you know, all these things and a lot of great feedback. And he asked me the question. He goes, are you self-employed or do you run a business? And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't get it. He's like, okay, well, if you run a business, then that means that that business can run without you. And another way to maybe ask the question is you could sell it and it could still continue to go on. If you're self-employed, it means like you are the business. And I was like, well, I guess in that sense, I'm both, because like currently this does not run without me. He's like, yeah, I know. I totally got it. And he was really just trying to like spark a little bit of thought and insights into me and started asking me about my exit strategy. I'm like, exit strategy? Like, I've barely started. What do you like? Why would I possibly be thinking about that now? He's like, I know you're not, which is why I'm here as like a mentor to you, to like kind of get you thinking a little bit longer term. But there is a difference between those two things. And there's no wrong answer. I want to make that very, very clear. There's no wrong answer. There's nothing wrong with being self-employed. And you, no matter what you do, you want to be a consultant and you want to start John Smith LLC and you are the company, and you spend the next 20 years of your life traveling the country or the world and doing, you know, giving your services or counsel or advice to whoever you want to serve. Like, that's great. Nothing wrong with it at all. I commend that person. It is, I would say, though, to my friend's point, different than running a business, building a business and running a business. And that is my intent. That's my mission. I'm trying to build something that will live beyond me. Those are two different schools of thought. So I think the sooner you can at least recognize that those are two different things and then use that to get crystal clear on at least beginning to make strategic decisions is gonna help you get closer to what you think you might want a little sooner than later. And then I think the last thing is, and I oftentimes talk to military personnel about this, is we are just so tailor-made for this world, because it's just, as you mentioned, Chad, it's just so hard. You're gonna get your teeth kicked in repeatedly. I think Elon Musk said this. I heard it from Alex Harmozy, who I think was quoting Elon, when he says entrepreneurship is like chewing on broken glass while staring into the abyss of death. And it may be one of the more accurate ways to describe it. That may sound negative, because I guess it kind of is, but it's also dead on accurate. Like, it's so hard and so painful, and yet you still go through it as you stare off into nothingness without any sense of, other than hope, that it all might be worth it, without even knowing what it even is. Like, that's a great example or depiction of what this world is like. So I think you got to be a little crazy, which is why I say military guys or gals are great for it, because you got to be a little off to want to go live that life, even for a short amount of time. But you also have this inherent mental toughness and resilience and, you know, discipline and these like undeniable themes of winning that are built within us that are requirements to make it, because that's usually what ends up with people off-ramping, is it gets too hot. You know, you can't take the losses, and it's like, this is just too chaotic. I need something more stable. I gave it a shot. All this stuff goes around and around, and it happens. Like, overwhelming statistically likelihood is that is what's going to happen. So you got to be able to take the hits and then keep taking the hits and then have a firm faith or belief in your vision and the value of what you bring to the world, but then also have enough flexibility and adaptability to learn along the way. And as you onboard people and you're starting to take in counsel and you're enabling others to do different things, you got to be able to pivot and spin and move. And like, the thing that you thought was the thing 6 months ago, maybe it's not the thing. It's like, okay, well, like, can I give that up and redirect it to a new direction? So it's a crazy world. You got to be a little off to get into it, or wildly ignorant that you didn't realize how difficult it is and how statistically unlikely you are to quote unquote make it. Either way, the truth is going to come directly into your face. And then if you choose to stay on this crazy journey, you've entered into the realm of crazy, at least a little bit crazy, which is why I'm like, hey, military people, like, you're already a little crazy. So like, you can do this. I don't have an MBA. I learn the language like sometimes daily. You can figure out like business. You do not have to have a wall full of degrees to figure this game out. You just have to have enough belief in yourself, what you're trying to do, and then enough toughness and resilience to just keep taking those hits and, you know, keep spinning and keep swinging. And I think you got two options. One is you just stay in the game long enough to win. And the second is that you quit. It's like, that's it. It's one of the two. So, you know, which one do you want to choose?
Yeah. 100%. Mac, you got any closing comments?
Nothing, man, but thank you. That's it, Nick. Appreciate your time, brother.
Nick, thank you so much. I encourage everybody to check out your book, Objective Secure, and check out what you guys are doing on social media and everything. It's awesome. Like, we watch it all the time. So thanks, Nick. I appreciate your time.
Appreciate you, boys. Chad, good luck with the 36-hour hell you're about to walk into. I'll be thinking about you, brother.
All right. Thanks.